And medically speaking, it's incurable. Now, that's pretty rough. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. Now, many doctors throughout this country and Canada give us their private opinion that if the brain explosions and heart failures that should be accredited to alcoholism were, right now, alcoholism would be first as a killer in the United States. I don't think that's too important. We're in the first three anyhow. You know, we get show money, even at the worst. And I think it's very significant because we would have to have one of the worst diseases. See, everything's got to be big in an alcoholic's life. Before I got to AA, I was always going to do something big. I never quite got around to it. But I was going to. One of my great dreams when I was lying back there in that bed of mine in an alcoholic stupor was of the big things I was going to do to get back in the good graces of my family and society. I remember one of them that recurred often. I was going to save the Pope in an earthquake. I'm not even a Catholic, and I doubt if you let me save him anyway. But that was going to take some doing, because I'm drunk at Beverly Hills, and he's over in Rome, see? But it was very necessary for us to do something big, because we never did the little things. You see, we never did the little things. And this is one of the wonderful things about our program. There's nothing big to do anymore. They're just little things, and the big things take care of themselves. And it's wonderful. And when we, as alcoholics, come to see the nature of our problem and fulfill the conditions laid down in our program, something happens to us. But I'm one who believes that either we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, or we have to come see the nature of our problem, lest we will not fulfill the conditions for sobriety. We are a peculiar breed of cats, we alkies. We have the ability to hear what we want to hear and see what we want to see, and interpret both that which we hear and see the way we want to interpret it. And we can't hear until we can. I got a great charge out of a little thing that happened on Art Linkletter's program some time back. He had a bunch of kids up there talking to him. And he asked them about the definition, their definition of a miracle. And he got to this little knot-headed boy, and he says, "What's your definition of a miracle?" And he says, "A miracle is something that can't happen until it does." And that's the way with us. The miracle of AA can't happen with us until it does. Now, I've heard several people say since I've been here, "I wish I could have found this thing 10 years sooner, or 20 years sooner or something." And I just laugh. I just laugh because we couldn't have found it 10 years sooner. We couldn't have found it 10 days sooner. You know, an alcoholic just don't make up his mind that he's got a problem and decide to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and surrender and get sober. There's a little preparation to go through. We got to get ready. And how long it takes, it takes. And what it takes, it takes. And until we can hear, we can't hear. Now, I agree with the medical definition, the disease of alcoholism, that it is a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. I go along with this. I am condemned by the obsessions of the mind to drink liquor, and I am condemned by the allergy of the body to die if I do. I know this because I spent 10 hot years in hell trying to prove that wasn't true. And I proved to my complete and total satisfaction that it is. So I agree. I also agree that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Medical science says that there's never been a case in history where anybody like me ever went back to normal drinking. I agree with this. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I agree that the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long, extended periods of total abstinence. I know that I'm 18 years and 7 months worse off so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned than I was when I got here. And just between us, I wasn't in what would be diagnosed as robust health when I got here. I know this is true, and I don't have to take a drink to prove it. Because I have been close to and active in this program for 18 years and 7 months. And when you're close to and active in, you don't have to take the drink to see if the physical part of the disease gets worse. Because your friends are forever doing it for you. You know? I had a twin in this program almost. Chap that came to the program the same month I did, January 1946. And for 15 straight years, he did a tremendous job in this program. He was one of the greatest speakers that ever came out of Southern California. Many of you have heard him or heard his tapes. 2 years ago, last Christmas, he got messing around with a little cough syrup. Codeine and alcohol. And the next thing you know, he was drinking a little, and the next thing you knew, we had to bury him. He didn't last 60 days after his first drink, after 15 straight years of total abstinence. So, you see, the physical side of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long, extended periods of total abstinence. And to date, there is nothing that can be done about the physical part of the disease. If we had all the money in the state of Colorado, it wouldn't be enough to send me someplace to have my body made over so I could successfully drink. All of this, I am fully aware of. Now, if seeing the physical side of the disease, you and I could decide to quit drinking and could do it, we wouldn't have a problem. We simply wouldn't have a problem. It's easy for us to see the physical side of the disease, that one drink's too many and a thousand's not enough, after it's explained to us. Now, this never occurred to me until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought it was the first drink that was killing me. I thought it was the last gallon. For 10 years, I was trying to find a way to shut it off before the trouble started. You see, my last drink, my trouble started on Wednesday. Now, if I'd just quit Tuesday, everything had been all right. And so I decided to quit Tuesday next time, but I'd forget to specify which Tuesday. But when I got here and you told me it was the first slug, I could see it very plainly. It's not that we alkies get drunk every time we take a drink. Particularly, this is not true with the periodic. We don't get drunk every time we take a drink. We get real cute about this thing. We come off drunk, and if you're like me and didn't know there was an easy way to sober up, you just died until you could live. Shook your liver out, walked up and down the living room floor, sweating, shaking, freezing, and dying until you could get well. And then you'd go into a real good build-up process. You'd eat a lot of vitamins, sleep well, drink a lot of milk, exercise, get real strong, and then you'd start to analyze. You'd take that last drink apart, see where you made your mistakes, decide not to do it that way anymore. And then you start sampling. And you sample your way right on back to bed, you see? But not quickly. Take quite a little time, because we got real cute about it. We'd experiment for a few weeks. So it isn't that we get drunk every time we take a drink. It's that we get drunk every time we take a drink before we quit taking a drink. You see? Always. It's just a question of time between the first slug and the drunk. And if seeing this we could decide to quit drinking and quit, we wouldn't have a problem in the world. We'd just say to ourselves, all right, the stuff isn't doing for me what it used to do. I can't get there anymore. I can get close, but I either go through or fall back. And so I'm not getting any fun out of it. There's nothing in it but trouble. And besides, it's getting so it hurts too bad to sober up. So I'll just cork up the bottle and put it on the shelf and leave it. Now, if we could do that, we wouldn't have a problem in the world. We'd do it. But we can't. Why? Because of the other half of the disease, the obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. The obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. The reason you never hear anything about willpower or backbone or standing up and being a man in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we know it's just as silly for an alkie to decide to quit drinking as it is for a tubercular to decide to quit coughing. The only way a tubercular can get rid of the cough is to get rid of its cause, tuberculosis. And the only way a guy like me can get rid of the bottle is to get rid of the mental obsessions that cause him to drink. You see, there is no physical demand for liquor when the body is dry. If there was, I'd be in the middle of a bad predicament this morning. Because I haven't had a drink or a tranquilizing or sedating pill for 18 years and 7 months. So I would really be hurting. But I'm not. I feel pretty good, thank you. There is no physical demand for liquor when the body's dry. It's only after the first slug that the physical takes over. The first drink is mental. The second drink and the 542nd drink are physical, but the first one is mental. And if you and I want to live without that bottle, we have to be rid of its cause, the obsessions of the mind. And that's what our program is all about. We recognize the physical part of the disease and recognize that we have no more good drinking time left, period, and never will have any more, period. And then turn to the other half of the disease, the cause. And this is what our program relieves us of, the obsessions of the mind. Now, due to our very nature, we either have to come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or death, or we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, because otherwise we will not do the things necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. We won't do it. Because the first condition for sobriety is surrender. This is the very first condition for sobriety. This is a battle we win by the recognition that we can't win, by the admission to ourselves of total defeat, and the abandonment of self to the simple program. And we will not do it unless we see that it's absolutely necessary, or that it is absolutely necessary. How are we going to get rid of the obsessions of the mind? We have a formula that is foolproof. And all we got to do is fulfill the conditions of the formula. And the first condition is that we accept ourselves as we are where we are. This is the first condition. We find it in chapter 3. It says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Now that's why these meetings are so very necessary. Because before we can identify with both halves of the disease of alcoholism, we have to identify with an alcoholic. This is our first identity with somebody like us. And the place to find somebody like us is in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And that's why these meetings are so necessary and so vital to us, if we be alcoholics, that we might be able to accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are. You know, until I completely and totally ran out of everything, including choice, it was never my fault that I drank. It was your fault. If you stupid people had have lived like I knew you should, and like I told you how, because I knew how you should live, and I told you. And if you just had performed like I thought you ought to, I wouldn't have had to drink. But you wouldn't do it, and so I got drunk at you. And I got drunk at a lot of you, believe me. That gal that you heard talking some of you yesterday afternoon, I used to get drunk at her. An awful lot, because she didn't perform like I knew she should. My boss, it was perfectly clear to me that I had all the brains in the organization. And he had all the money and was trying to tell me what to do. I got drunk at him. But my last and best excuse was my wife's mother. There was a king-size excuse, believe me. We had a mutual hating society that was beautiful to behold. You see, she only had one kid. And I was married to her. And she was living with us. And she had a grandstand seat watching me crucify her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. You see, if she hadn't have been there, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. It was never my fault until I ran out of time. And from the day that I came to see that if there be fault, it is mine, from that moment until right now, I have never had to take a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill. And it happened to me in the middle of the worst drunk that I'd ever been on. And I had nothing in my body but liquor. Nothing. But I woke up with a little period of sanity, and I saw me as I was and accepted me as I was. And although I had a lot of dying to do after that, I haven't had any more drinking to do. Or pilling to do. It's one of the greatest days in the life of any individual when he can and does accept himself as he is and starts going from there. The second condition we find in chapter 3. Chapter 5. It says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Now this means to me that sobriety has to be number one if we be alcoholic. It has to be tops on our hit parade. And I am convinced clear through from top to bottom that the very minute that anything gets more important to an alcoholic than his sobriety, he is on thin ice. I don't think the time can ever come with us when anything gets between us and our program and our God, lest we be on thin ice. This is awful hard for some of us to come to see. And particularly is it hard for some of our mates to come to see. In my early days, my good wife was in the process of getting rid of me legally. She hadn't had me for quite a spell anyway. But she didn't want me around the house. I was cluttering up the place. And I had accepted the fact that she was gone and should be gone and that I wasn't entitled to have her back. And so I never talked to her about this program. I never said anything to her about it. For 6 months. Because I had decided the first night that I got to a meeting that I wanted what you had, and I became willing to go to any length to get it. But I had a great fear upon me. The fear that I didn't have enough left to get it. And for 6 months, I was in a meeting every night with this great fear upon me. Because I didn't bring a body or a mind to my first meeting. Many of you have heard me say it took me 3.5 years to get over falling on my face after my last drunk. And it took me over 6 months to put the serenity prayer, this beautiful little serenity prayer, together in English, not spiritually, in English. So I brought neither a mind or a body, and I was so burdened with this fear that I couldn't have it, that I didn't have enough left to get it. And so I never discussed anything about this program with my wife until 6 months had gone by, and I had awakened to the fact that I was sober. and had been from the very first meeting. And then I started talking with her about it. Well, unbeknownst to me, she had read my book. And she wanted to go with me. And I took her. And she's been going with me ever since. But after 3 or 4 months, I was asked to say a few words in my own group. And I got up and talked a little, and I said, now, if it was necessary tonight for me to go to Tibet to maintain what I found here, I would go home, pack my grip, come through the living room, kiss my wife, and say, honey, it's too bad, but I've got to go. Well, we got home. Pretty soon I had noticed that the house was shaking. And I look over and she's bawling her eyes out. And I said, well, honey, what's the matter? And she says, oh, what you said. She says, for the first time in our lives, we have a little chance for some happiness. For a little joy and a little peace around this house. And you'd go to Tibet. She says, don't I mean anything to you? Don't the kids mean anything to you? Don't the home mean anything to you? And I just let her cry, and it slowed down. And I says, honey, do I mean anything to you, drunk? And she says, no. Do I mean anything to these kids, drunk? And she says, no. Do I mean anything to me or to life, drunk? No. And I said, well, can't you see that this has to be number one? And she couldn't. But you heard her say yesterday that if it were necessary for us to go through this 10 years of hell to find what we had found, that she was glad that it happened. And she's a non-alcoholic. And she would tell you, if you ask her, that anything that I feel that's necessary to maintain myself in this way, she okays, regardless of what it is. We must come to see that this is number one and must remain so. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And then it says, here are the steps we took. And this is one of the most significant programs in our book. I mean, one of the most significant lines in our book. Here are the steps we took. T-double-O-K, took. We're sober. Now, if you happen to be an alcoholic, and if you want to get rid of that flit, took him. Took him. Because when you took him, something happens. And when you don't took him, nothing happens. Here are the steps we took. Now, it doesn't say here are the steps we heard read, or here are the steps we read, or here are the steps we discussed in last night's discussion meeting, or here are the steps we interpreted. That interpreted just drives me nuts. You know what that first step to me step meant to me 18 years and 7 months ago? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Do you know what it means to me this morning, 18 years and 7 months later? We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. That's all. I'd like to hear some bright boy or girl jump up and interpret that. Thank God I got here too late to interpret. Doesn't say interpreted. It says took. Neither does it say here are the steps we con God into taking for us. God has everything to do with our program. He is the author of it and the father of our miracle. But this isn't one of the things. Here are the steps I take myself, personally, applying to my very own life. And I haven't had to drink anymore. Now, this is the formula. This is the simplicity of our program, and this is the only thing that's wrong with our program. It is that simple. It is that simple. But you and I are not that simple. We look at this thing and we say, it can't be that simple. There's bound to be a tougher way than this, and I'm going to find it. We say if these black lines have got so much potency, these white lines have got something in them too. And we start reading between the lines. We can't get simple enough to see that 500,000 men and women are living a sober, normal, not normal, AA way of life. As the result of applying these steps to their very own lives as honestly as they know how, one day at a time. And letting the chips fall where they may. When we get simple enough to do this, to abandon ourselves completely to this simple program, to let go absolutely, to do these simple things one day at a time to the best of our ability. And incidentally, that's enough. This isn't a program of great learning. Neither is it a program of great ability. It's a program of attitude and effort. Attitude and effort. The only thing you and I need to know that we didn't know when we got here was the nature of our problem. This is very good to know. Very good to know that I'm physically and mentally different than the non-alcoholic drinker. It's a good thing. And this we need to know. But that's the only thing we need to know that we didn't know when we got here. And the only ability we need is what we got, if we use it all. Because when we use it all, what we lack is supply. This is the miracle of AA. And so I'd love to talk about the 12 steps, and I'd love to talk about the 12 traditions this morning, but I'm not going to do it. These are the conditions boiled down. The recognition that we've lost the battle. The admission, personal admission, and acceptance of the fact that we have lost the battle of life. The recognition of the need for help from any place. From any place. If there be any atheists or agnostics in the room this morning, let this not bother you in the least. Just the recognition of the need for help from any place is enough to start with. And then enough honesty to see ourselves as we are and enough honesty to do something about it. Namely, to practice these principles in all of our affairs one day at a time. And the rest will come. I've seen atheists come to this program that were so bitter they'd spit on the floor every time the word God was mentioned. And I've seen them remain to thank God from the soles of their feet. Just the recognition of the need for help. There's nothing in our book that says you need come here believing. Our book says we came to believe. And when we do these simple things one day at a time, we can't keep from coming to believe. Because we move out of hell into heaven. And there's nothing left to do but thank God. And this is our program of recovery. If you want these things, do these things. Now I want to start over. I said that I agreed with the doctor about the disease of alcoholism. But I think, and most of you think I know, that there is another part to the disease of alcoholism. Of course, it is physical and mental. But it is also spiritual. A basic spiritual unrest is the basic problem. Alcoholism is a living problem, and you and I have to have a living answer. If alcohol alone caused alcoholism, every excessive drinker would be an alcoholic. But many good Saturday night drunks are not alcoholics at all. Alcoholism is a basic living problem, and you and I have to have a basic living answer. Now, what do I mean by that? Why am I not drunk this morning? Sunday? I'm a couple of thousand miles from home. It's a beautiful day. Why am I not drunk? There's no better day to be drunk than Sunday, when it's Sunday, you know? Why am I not drunk? Because I have the thing that I was looking for in the bottle. I got it. I got the thing. Now, what is the thing? I don't hurt in here anymore. That king-size hurt is gone. I'm not fighting me, I'm not fighting you, and I'm not fighting my God. I am at peace with me and you and my very own God. And that's the only reason I am not drunk. I don't kid myself for 30 seconds. If I hurt in here like I hurt 20 years ago, I would be drunk as I was drunk 20 years ago. Without this thing, which we call the miracle of AA, this morning I am a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. And I am not in the least concerned about saying that, neither am I in the least afraid of it. I know it. I can't stay sober of myself. So, it is a state of being that allows me to be sober this morning. There isn't anything that a drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill could do for me but tear me down. I don't need it, therefore I don't have to have it. Now, why was I drunk 20 years ago? For the same reason, a state of being. A state of being that was so lousy that I had to get drunk to get a little peace. Why does a guy or a gal that is otherwise a pretty fine person, why do we keep fighting this battle for 10 years after we've lost? For two reasons, I think. Number one is that we can't admit defeat. We cannot admit defeat. It's against our nature. We have to win, and so we're in there fighting. I was saying to myself 5 years after everybody quit listening to me, I'll beat this thing if it's the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last. Is that the only peace I ever knew, until I found my peace in Alcoholics Anonymous, was when I was just right with that flip. When I had just enough to make everything all right with me and with you, and life was good. This is the only peace I ever knew. I have 18 years and 7 months of sobriety to look back over. 25 years of drinking. And the time before that. And although I never had a drink until I was as big as I am now. Out of school, I was an athlete. And I was always in training. And I never took liquor. And I never smoked either, for that matter. Until I was out of school. But even back as far as my memory goes, I was a misfit in life. I could not integrate myself in the life around me. Although I wanted so much to be a part of, I was forever apart from, until I found myself in AA. And the only peace I ever knew was when I was just right. And as things became more and more confused, and as the truth dawned on me that I was going backwards, that the turtles of life were passing me up like they were on motorcycles, and I was yelling out, why, and there was no answer but a why. And remembering these times of peace, I'd get that bottle and try to get back there. And I couldn't make it. But I kept trying because it's the only peace I'd ever known. Now you'll notice a while ago, I said, if there be fault, it is mine. I said that purposely, because I do not believe there is fault. You can't tell me that there is any alcoholic in the world that enjoys the life he has to live after he becomes a compulsive drinker. This is one of the things that makes it so hard for the world to understand. Because we don't understand ourselves. An alcoholic is just as different on the inside from the thing he shows to the world as day is different from night. I think we were born with a combination of characteristics, all of which are good when we learn how to live with them, that make it impossible for us to integrate into the life we see around us. Not that we don't want to. We want to. But we can't. One of the things that just drives me nuts was the little scene in the Days of Wine and Roses. You remember these two kids who were both heavy drinkers, and they fell in love, and they drank together, and they got married. And they both became alkies, tore up the place, and were separated. And he went ahead and found his way in AA, and she couldn't. And she loved a guy, and she came to try to get him to come back with her. And they were in an apartment high above the city of New York. And she was looking out the window. And he was begging her to join him in this way of life. And she finally says, I can't. She says, when I look out at this window sober, it's dirty and it's ugly. And when I look out drunk, it's beautiful. This just tears the heart out of me. Because for 25 years, the only way I could stand what I saw was when I was half drunk. You see, we're a bunch of perfectionists. Every alcoholic ever knew perfection. Now, perfectionism is good when we learn how to live with it. Because there's that great drive, you know, that goes with it. There's the inability to settle for the normal. We have to have things better than normal. And this is good. But there's also the inability to settle for anything less than perfection. And this is the thing that made us make over the world. This is the thing that made us make over our wives and our husbands. They weren't according to our standards. And we had to make them over. And this isn't a good way to make friends and influence people. People don't want to be made over. I have to laugh about the little story of the attorney that had the two sons, you remember? And he couldn't wait till these boys got big enough to get him into the Boy Scouts. And they finally made it. And every time he'd come home, they'd have a little ritual, you know. He'd end up by saying, "John, did you do your good turn today?" "Yes, Father, what was it?" And so he came home this day, and they go through their little ritual. And he says, "John, did you do your good turn today?" He says, "Yes, Father, I did." He says, "What'd you do?" Said, "I helped an old lady across the street." "Oh," I says, "that's wonderful. Jim," he says, "how about you?" He says, "Yes, Father, I did too." "Well," he says, "what'd you do?" He says, "I helped John take the old lady across the street." "Why," he says, "that's no project. Why didn't you get your oh," he says, "you don't know, Dad." He says, "the old lady didn't want to cross the street." Here we are, a bunch of perfectionists trying to make the world over, and they don't want to be made over. And we're frustrated. Now, another thing, for some reason, we were born with the interior awareness that life should be a beautiful and a good and a big thing. Every alcoholic on earth knows it. It came with us, inside of us. One of the lines in one of Wordsworth's poems says it better than I can. It says, "Not in complete forgetfulness, nor yet in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory did we come from heaven, which is our home." And this is our picture of life. And we look at it, and it's not. And we can't integrate. We are rebels, not of our choice. And lastly, we're highly emotional people, very sensitive, and we get hurt very, very quickly and very easily. The psychiatrists the world over say we are emotionally immature, we drunks. I don't believe it. I think it's because we're born with such a high degree of sensitivity. We get hurt so badly by everything in life. And at a very early date, we start building that wall around us to keep from getting hurt. And as we go along, we exclude, we chip off, we build this wall thicker and higher. Because we can't get hurt anymore. And we won't let anybody in to that inner sanctum because we know they're going to hurt us. I don't think this is emotional immaturity. I think it's a living problem that we have to find the answer for. I've stood before this many and more people in Folsom Prison. Folsom Prison is maximum security. You can't even get in there for murder if it's the first time. You gotta be an habitual to get into Folsom. So those guys are supposed to be pretty tough. And I've stood up there and watched 250 of them bawl right along with me. Shamelessly, and let the tears bounce off of their bellies. And it wasn't because they were emotionally immature. It was because of the great identity. They were inside just like me. And there was that great identity, one with another. Now with this kind of a combination, turned loose on the world, something has to happen. And it's in our search for this something that we find alcohol. And alcohol is not a problem to us. It's an answer proving that the problem was already there. You see? Alcohol was no problem to me for 15 years. I got drunk and I got sober when I wanted to. I called the shots. I drank according to a very strict code. And it was an answer. An answer that I needed very badly. But after 15 years, the answer being the wrong answer turned into the problem. And it beat me to death. The only thing I knew that would give me a little peace and eventually oblivion, wouldn't even give me oblivion. And I could drink that flip to the tumbler, and I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober, and I couldn't live, and I couldn't die. And if there's any hell any hotter than that, I hope I miss it. Searching, 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 and unable to find. Because we can't fulfill the condition. Because of our conditioning. The weak man surrenders. The strong man wins the victory. And we have to stay in there and fight. Well, now, the reason I'm so slap happy on this program is because I can take no credit whatsoever for being here. I could not come to Alcoholics Anonymous until I'd run out of choice. My choice was never to come here. And I had to run out of everything, including choice, before I could come. I can't even take credit for living to get to my first meeting. Because on my next to the last drunk, I drove 6,000 miles in a blackout. I don't remember 5% of 6,000 miles in 2 weeks. So something must have been taken care of before I even got here. And I think it was the prayers of my non-alcoholic relatives and friends that allowed me even to get here. And so I am the most fortunate, one of the most fortunate, along with you, one of the most fortunate people that live. Because I am here because of the accident, a total failure in every department of life. And when there was nothing left to do, I abandoned myself to nothing. And came here. What for? To find God? No. To find an answer to life? No. My life was over. To get my wife back? No. She was gone and should be gone. And I wasn't entitled to have her back. To get back the love of the kids? No. It was gone. To get my job back? No. No. I'd forfeited all rights to that job. Just for sobriety. And I didn't even want sobriety for myself because my life was done. I knew I was going to die. I had almost made it the time before. The oxygen squad had had to come and wake me up. The last time out. So I knew that death was imminent, but I didn't care. I must be sober until I died. Because I didn't want to die with the records. I didn't want that wife of mine and those kids to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. And I must be sober until I kicked over in order to rub out as much as I could. And I came here for one reason and one reason only, hoping against hope that I might find a way that didn't include that flesh. And you told me not only the nature of my problem, but what you'd done. And you said, if you want to do it. And that's all I've done. For 18 years and 7 months, I have attempted to practice these principles in all of my affairs one day at a time. First, for sobriety. And after I'd awakened to the fact that I had it, then, just because I wanted to. Just because I wanted to. Because, you see, this is the thing I had to have since the day I was born. How fortunate can a man be? How very fortunate can a man be? I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth. Just as long as it didn't include liquor. And thought I had a bargain. And I've had sobriety for 18 years and 7 months. And along with it has come everything else that makes for a wonderful, good, full life. How fortunate can we be? Again. I do not believe that we're at fault. I think that the drinking experience is a part of the search for unity. The search for unity that we might be a part of. The life that I enjoy in Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly the life that I was born knowing that we should have. This is the thing itself. Now I'm going to close with a little thing. I've been asked to do it. And I love it. And I'm glad I was asked. A little thing that I have known since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. But never understood until I was sober some 5 years. It's one of our parables, the parable of the prodigal son. And it is my story, and it is your story, and it is our story. And it explains to me better than anything I've ever thought about, read about, or heard. And it explains you to me, and it explains us in our relationship to life, to God. Better than anything I've ever known. And it goes something like this. A certain wealthy man, God, had two sons. You and I. And the youngest one of them came to his dad and he said, Dad, I've got me some big ideas. I'm going over to California. And cut me a big pig over there. I've got lots of things to do. Got a lot of ideas, a lot of opportunities out there in California. Give me my inheritance. Father didn't say, wait a minute, son. We're wealthy. We've got everything you need right here. Stay home. You're liable to get out there in California, away from home, consciously separated from, and get in trouble. You might run onto a blonde out there with a bottle of muscadoodle and get into a lot of trouble.
Stay home.
No. He didn't argue with the kid at all. He gave him his inheritance without an argument. Just gave it to him. And the kid went away from home. Into a far country. Away from home, away from God. Conscious separation. And wasted his substance on riotous living. Now, maybe you didn't do that. But this sounds suspiciously like me. Just exactly. And after he'd spent all, what'd he do? Come back home? No. After the famine? What then? No. That famine tickled him, too. If there's ever a bunch of people that should be able to understand the famine, it's us. I don't think they make famines like that no more, you know? You come off a drunk, you're as hot as a two-bit pistol. Half of your friends are trying to bank one of your checks with a tennis racket. That's a famine. After he'd spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and the kid came to want. But he didn't come home. He did just like you did, just like I did. He went to a man in that country. You and I went to the doctor, to the psychiatrist. Ah, we got nothing against those people. We went to Timbuktu. We went every place, but we didn't come back home. So he went to a man in that country. And the man put him to work. And of all the things he might have put him to doing, he didn't. He put him to tending pigs. Now, this is very significant. This is very significant because he's telling us to what depth the kid had gone. You see, this was a Jew boy telling this story, and they don't like pigs. They just don't like pigs, that's all. And for a Jew to have to tend pigs, there's nothing worse. And so the boy was down. We got a word for it in AA. We call it low bottom. And so he started tending pigs, and while he was in the pig pit, he got hungry. And he fain would eat the husks that the pigs did eat. And no man gave unto him. He was beyond human help. We got a line to that, too. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood it. Probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Beyond human help, you see. And so he got hungry, and no man gave unto him. And in his desperation, he remembered. I've been in that pizza. You've been in that pizza. I think I know all about that thing. And he had that moment of truth. He said to himself, I'm a failure. I'm no good. I've sinned against God and man. But he remembered that in his father's house was plenty to spare. And immediately, like the alcoholic, he said, I can't go back home. I can't go back there and say, look, Dad, here's your son. I've come home. Can't do it. Because I'm a sinner, I'm no good. I'm not entitled to it. But he also remembered that the servants back there had more than he. And he says, I will go back and ask my dad to put me on as a hired servant. So he made the decision. He says, I will arise and go to my father.
And now here's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The father saw him a long ways off and came to meet him. Ah, this is the miracle of AA. The father saw him a long ways off and came to meet him. And the father saw me a long ways off and came to meet me. Because when I got to that first meeting, I was convinced before I even got through the door that I was in the wrong place. Because I saw a bunch of people like you. And you weren't dressed like me. And you didn't feel like me. And you didn't look like me. And you were all yakking. Every one of you. Yak, 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 yak. Nobody listened. Everybody talking. And it was all happy talk. And I was apart from, not a part of, that happy talk. And I said to myself, they've given me a bum steer, because you see, I never had a sponsor. I went there alone. And only an alcoholic knows what it means to be alone. Only an alcoholic. And I said to myself, they've given me the wrong night. These are the veterans and their wives, and they're here for party. Because it was in the Veterans War, Foreign Wars Hall, where the meeting was held. And I said to myself, I've got to go home and come back the night the drunks are here. And I turned to leave. And if I was dead when I got there, I was double dead when I turned to leave. Because this I needed so badly. And as I started away, the man hurried over to the door and he said to me, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. But he said, what were you looking for? And I said, well, if it would interest you, I was looking for sobriety. Because, you see, I thought he was a veteran. And the guy lit up like a Christmas tree. His whole being changed. He just lit up. And he says to me, why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And God came to meet me through him, who had already found his way. And so the kids started trying to tell God what a bad boy he'd been. His father. And again, the father didn't hear him. There wasn't any argument. The father didn't say, yes, I know what you've done. You sure are a stinker. You've messed things up, but good, and I've got the record on you. Now get to grubbing hole and get back here on the back 40 and start to work on those persimmon sprouts and sassafras bushes. And maybe 25 years from now, if you've done a good job, I might invite you in to have lunch with me. No. Just as it was when the kid went away, it was when he came back home. There was no argument. No argument at all. No condemnation. The father fell on his neck and kissed. And he put a ring on his finger, the symbol of eternal life, no beginning and no end. And he calls the servant. And he says, kill the fatted calf. Let's have a party. The boy was lost. And he's come back home. Even as you now. It's not normal to walk alone. I walked alone for 43 years. It's not normal to walk alone. It's cold outside. It's normal for us to walk down the high road of life with our arms around each other.
sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. This is normal. And it's not normal for us to be away from the Father's house. It's normal for us to become as little children, totally dependent on this great thing called God. Now this morning all things are good with me. I'm sober. My family was put back together. My health was put back together. My business was put back together. I have you. And I have a good life. All things are good with me. But you're looking at the most dependent man you'll ever see. I am totally dependent. I cannot run my life. I cannot run my wife. I cannot run my business. I can't run nothing. And I know it. What can I do? I can practice these principles in all of my affairs one day at a time to the best of my ability. And I can share me with anybody that wants me in love. And if that's not good enough, I've got to die. Because that's all I can do. But so far, it's worked out pretty well. Because I never had it so good. And my dependency is not a dependency of fear. It's a dependency of certainty. That comes with walking in this way. It's my business to do these things, and it's God's business to take care of. And He has done an infinitely better job than I could do. I gave my all. I gave my family, my health, my job, my money, and my sanity. I spent it all to do this thing. Ended up in the pig pen. And by the grace of God, through your help, came back home to a banquet. Is it any wonder that I'm here? This is no joke for me. I have to be here. I have to be here. I can't be anyplace else. I love this broken. And I love its people. And I love its God, who is my God. And I can't keep from talking about it. It's been a great joy to be with you. I'm taking back to California 1,000 times more than I was able to get. Because I am one, and you are many. And to think that we can sit and walk and talk with each other about our own failures and about our own good fortune and realize from whence it comes and laugh and cry together, saying one to another, didn't our hearts burn within us as He walked with us and talked with us by the wayside? This is AA, that we walk with our hand in the hand of God and our arm around the dream.